Bhagavato Savaka Sango Iyaya Patipano Bhagavato Savaka Sango Samichi Patipano Bhagavato Savaka Sango Yadita Chatari Purisa Yugani Atta Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sango Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjali Karaniyo Anuttarang Punyaketang Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasa Namami.
From hatred and ill will, where the
standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Okay. See what questions we have tonight.
Patience. Thank you. I needed his help. That's actually on now. Your water's fine, yes. Excellent. Okay, some questions here. In Hong Kong, when somebody passed on, we usually get monks to do chanting at least 2 to 3 times during the 49 days. After that person passed on, is it necessary to do so? No. Sometimes a lot of chanting gets done 2 to 3 times during the 49 days. The 49 days, though, is an interesting idea. And of course, being sort of a scientist, a Westerner, and Kwai Lo, Yis Tom Vam Singh, is it really necessary? Where does the 49 days come from? But it was one experience which I had when our treasurer of the monastery in Thailand, where I spent so much time, the treasurer's daughter got cancer. She was really young, maybe sort of 23 or 22 or something. And unfortunately, nothing worked, so she got more and more sick and eventually passed away. But she was a very good Buddhist and very good spiritual person. She never really complained with the difficulties and the pain of that final days. But because it was a treasurer's daughter, he was an important member of the committee, that we went to see her a few times, and I knew the time when she died, and of course, we did a funeral service for her and a cremation. But then what happened next was one morning, the treasurer, he came on the first available car, from the town to this monastery, and I said, "Why are you here so early?" And he said, "Because something happened early this morning." In the Asian tradition, just people will sit down on the floor with different pieces of food, and they'd all sit around to have their breakfast together. And this was no big houses. They had, you know, maybe just the uncles and aunties and the treasurer and his wife and cousins and daughters and sons. There's about 16 or 17, 18 people in the house, you know, for breakfast. You know, sitting around, just taking a bit of this and a bit of that. And it was then when one of his other sort of children said, "Oh, I just happened to say in passing, I had a dream of, you know, my sister. You know, she came to see me last night and just said it's time for me to go and I'll take my leave." And at that, everybody stopped eating. And everybody's, you know, 16, 17 people who lived in that house, family, they all had the same dream the night before. That their sister or their daughter, their cousin, whatever the relationship was with them, everyone in the house reported that the girl who died had come to pay respects and just to say, "It's time for me to go now." And it was such an obvious, it can't be coincidence. Everybody in the house had the same dream, the same person that night. And so he came and said, "Well, now what's going on?" And of course, I just said that she's come to say goodbye. But then, because I knew the time she died, the day she died, there's something kind of clicked in me. And I looked at the calendar and counted the days, and it was precisely 49 days. She'd been staying around for 49 days, not 50, not 48, just to make sure everything is done properly, and then leave. So that was one case, and you know, you can't sort of put it down to anything else, but that girl stayed 49 days before she passed on. So because of that, that we do have these ceremonies and traditions of, you know, doing some, all it is really doing some good karma for the person who's passed away and dedicating the merits to them. How on earth does that work? It's similar to maybe your elderly mother or your grandfather. You know, he's sending him off to Australia to visit this monastery. And you're in Hong Kong, you take him to the airport, and because he's a bit old, you know, you say, I'll do the check-in for you. Just, you know, sit down, Kong Kong. Is that right, Kong? Kong? Kong Kong, your grandfather?
Kong Kong.
Kong Kong. Kong Kong. It's close. Not bad. Kong Kong. So he said, "Kong Kong, sit down and I'll do the check-in for you." And you take his ticket and passport, and he's your father or grandfather, and he's, you know, you love him to bits, and he's looked after you so well in his life. And you say, ask the person at the check-in counter, you know, "Is there any chance of an upgrade?" And so, "Well, there's a few seats up in business class or even first class. It's your Kong Kong, you know, it's worth it." So you get out your credit card, upgrade him to first class. And so, you know, it costs you money, but it's a wonderful thing to do. And you tell your grandfather, "Here's your ticket, first class. You know, because, you know, I love you and I care for you. And it's my way of showing my gratitude and respect to you." You upgrade him. And that's what we do when somebody dies. We do some chanting or do some charity work and we give the merits of good karma, you know, to your Kong Kong. And so that it's like upgrading them to a better rebirth. At least a part of that rebirth, you upgrade them. And it's worth it. And even if it doesn't work, you know, because they've already sort of got lots and lots of karma, or they just won't receive that good karma because, you know, they're a negative person. Just the very fact you have an opportunity to do something good and kind for your person you love, it's a beautiful act of giving. Whether they receive it or not is not the point. We need to give. And that does always remind me of that story which I read so long ago, and it was of the Dalai Lama when he was still in Tibet. And a journalist, you know, that's before the Dalai Lama was really famous, but a journalist was following him just to, you know, do an article on his life. And the Dalai Lama would go from village to village in Tibet, some poor parts, so that people could see him. And in some villages, people would line up to give him things. And the journalist never really understood what generosity was, and was getting more and more, he's a Western journalist, more and more upset and angry, because he knew the Dalai Lama lived in a palace, had everything he'd ever wanted, didn't need anything. But then still these people were coming up to give him things. And then the journalist, he just lost it. He blew up and got so angry when he saw this really poor woman who'd hardly had anything, just lined up and just gave this Dalai Lama a skirt, a woman's skirt. And he just lost it, and he just shouted and screamed and said, "You call yourself a holy man, a spiritual leader, and you're taking a skirt, a woman's skirt, from this lady? She needs it more than you. You can't wear a skirt. You've got so many robes. Why are you taking this skirt from a woman? You don't need it. She's really poor." And the Dalai Lama, like many people who, you know, who are good monks, good nuns, they listen. They don't get upset when people shout at them. They just be calm and listen. And then afterwards he said, "You're right. I don't need that skirt, but that woman needed to give it to me." And at that Westerner understood what generosity was. It's not whether your deceased Gong Gong needs anything, but you need to give. And of course, the skirt will be just passed to some other poor person, and some other poor person's skirt will be passed to that lady who gave him something. It all goes around, it doesn't get wasted. But sometimes, you know, how I was brought up was, you know, you give to people who need to receive. But I never learned before that you give because I need to give. And so that was very important. And so every now and again, if it's, you know, my mother and father died a long time ago, but, you know, every now and again, just if I can do something for somebody, then I just dedicate the merits to my father or dedicate it to my mother. And I think, wow, I just was talking with the monks today. You know, it's coming up to, you know, my birthday. And this year we're not doing a big celebration in a hotel like we did last a few years. But I realise I'm not going to get away with not celebrating it or doing something. So I thought, I know what, I'm going to dedicate the merits, whatever sort of donations come on my birthday. Because it's my birthday, I'm going to dedicate it to the person who was involved in my birthday, my mum. So I'm going to. And he said, "What are you doing that for?" I said, "Brahmin, she died a long time ago." "It doesn't matter. She may not need to receive any good karma, but I need to give it. I need to do something. I need to sort of remember somebody who was so involved in my birth." And just all those the months before, carrying me in her womb and just looking after me those first, you know, few weeks of my life and weeks afterwards. I need to do something. So that's what giving is all about. So you get monks to do chanting at least 2-3 times during the 49 days. They don't need to do that much chanting. But what you need to do is to do something kind and good. It doesn't need to be 49 days, any time. If it's your mum, your dad, or somebody you really care about, your Gong Gong or whatever, then it's nice to be able to give. Giving is the act of love. You know, you give birthday presents, you give like Valentine's Day presents, not the cards with 13 diamonds in, don't do that. That's only a joke, not a suggestion. But you give, and it's an expression, because sometimes I say, well, you know, I'll just, I can't sort of, you know, say just how much you meant to me, but I can say I can give something. And that's always been an act of showing respect to somebody. And anyway, that's you don't need to do all that chanting. 2 to 3 times, once, twice. But you know what happens these days? You know, in not just Chinese culture, but just Western culture, if you keep it simple, you know, it's your father's funeral service, if you keep it simple, people feel you don't love your father, you don't respect him. And so a lot of times people in many cultures, they spend so much money and they almost bankrupt themselves because they think they have to do that to show how much they cared for their parents. And even though the parent, if they were alive, they said, don't spend so much, you don't need to do that. I don't want you to sort of suffer because of my passing away, my death. So it's nice when, if you are about to die, pass away, you know, your time is coming close, you know, because some cancer or just old age, and the doctor says, well, you know, you probably won't last this winter. Then you just tell all of your loved ones, say, look, do not spend too much money on my funeral. You don't need to actually to invite all the monks, especially the expensive ones. If I'm around, I'll come and chant for you for free. You know, I'm bad for their business. I undercut the market prices. And I like doing that because it's just doing it as an act of kindness and generosity. And you know, do something useful for that person. I often say that sometimes, should I make sort of a contribution to the monastery or some temple? So, well, what would they really like your money to be spent on? You know, did they sort of always contribute to, you know, the old people's home or something? Yeah, contribute to an old people's home. You know, did like they have a lovely, say, cat who they love to bits, then go and give it to a cat's home or something. Give a donation which your parents would really be proud of and would think, wow, what a wonderful thing that is doing. They're respecting, you know, who I was and what I cared for in this world. And that's a wonderful thing to do. And that is some of the best and highest karma. You know, you are giving a gift which makes them happy. Not which makes me happy, or which makes the temple treasurer happy. Give it to what, you know, it's for your father, for your mother, whatever. And there's the ones who should be considered what they want it to go to. Anyway, that's only one question. I always do the same thing, but it's a good question, so thank you for asking that question. Hi Ajahn, I'm a housewife with a very busy husband and no kids. How to overcome boring and loneliness in daily life and put meaning into it? You know what many people are doing these days? They're getting what is called fur babies. So the wife doesn't have a kid, they have a fur baby, otherwise known as a little dog or a cat. Which actually gives a lot of kindness and compassion to you, which is a wonderful friend, and which doesn't cost any money by having to send it to school, which doesn't give you any problems when it comes to, you know, they're getting the hormones start raging inside of them and they get into problems with this person or that person, and you don't have to worry about setting them up in a career in life. Imagine having a little fur baby, a cat or a dog, just saves you so much money, and also you don't have to discipline the little cat or dog like you sometimes have to discipline your kids and feel guilty about it afterwards. And just the medical bills are very, very cheap, and just they're so obedient. They don't play loud music, and spend all their time just sit on computer games. I've never seen a dog playing a computer game all night. So they don't drive you crazy, they just give all the time. And so having a little dog in the house or a cat in the house, wow, I mean, sometimes that's much better than having a kid. For those of you who've had kids, you know that one. They give you lots of rewards as well, lots of kindness if you get a very good one. But a dog or a cat, wow, that's the best. So have a fur baby. So have a housewife with a very busy husband and no kids, so get a little cat or a little dog. Boring and loneliness in daily life, that will keep you sort of happy. But if not that, and if you are into meditation, I'll just do some meditation, do some actually services. Because sometimes when you meet other people, if you don't like dogs and cats, meeting other people in a sort of a monastery or a temple or in a church or any social club, that is one of the great antidotes to depression. Because sometimes people think, oh, you take the medication or you do counseling or you do some mindfulness training, overcomes depression. Well, one of the great antidotes to depression is doing social service. You go to an old people's home and there are people there that they don't get any visitors. Their children or their relations are just too busy. So you just adopt one. You go there and you start talking and they open up to you about their life and you get a really good friend and they're very grateful that you come and visit them. And you feel, first of all, you feel good about yourself. You're doing some service to others. But you soon find out, like everybody does, that it's not you're helping this old person in the hospital or in the facility. They give far more to you than you'll ever give to them. And that's why that you learn and become so rich emotionally by serving in a place where they need some visitors. So that's actually just how one of the cures of depression, which is not focused on enough, serving others, doing some volunteer work. You meet some amazing people, and also that you feel, you know, some energy inside of yourself. It's not about you anymore, it's about serving in society. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, I'm a control freak and a very secure... very secured person? I mean, probably insecure person, you mean. How to be more relaxed and loosen the control and be more like a passenger? One of the ways is, you know, you come to a place like this where there's lots of kind people. This is the simile which is taught by the Buddha and was a powerful little teaching of the elephant who went bad. And that was such a powerful little story that, you know, in that second book which I wrote, the second story book, which is sometimes called Don't Worry, Be Grumpy, that was the title of that book in the United States, the Grumpy book, because the first book was the Dung book, you know, so it came together, got some weird titles over there, but it did okay. And in Singapore, in Australia, the two books were Open the Door of Your Heart and Don't Worry, Be Hopi. Oh no, it wasn't Don't Worry, Be Hopi, it was Good, Bad, Who Knows. And sort of in the German edition, which was incredibly popular, was a real legitimate bestseller, and that was actually of all books. And that book was called The Elephant That Lost Its Happiness. And that was such a powerful story for them that they made that the title. And that story was of the king's elephant. And the king's elephant was always a very well-behaved elephant, which is why the king just adopted him. And that was like his chariot. That's what the king would use to go through the jungles, sit on top of the elephant. Because you imagine the elephant's very, very high, so it can actually go through jungle areas without being like a horse who gets sort of wouldn't be able to get through those jungle areas. So the elephant was the king's elephant, where the king would actually go on journeys. It was like the Rolls Royces of transport in those days. So this was a very good, trained, well-behaved elephant. But then, in the space of a couple of days, the elephant started to get cranky. You know, when the king passed by, the elephant, you know, sucked up all the water in his trunk and soaked His Majesty the King, which wasn't nice. He'd never do that before. He's just really respectful. And also, just know when the trainer, the elephant keeper, was actually, the elephant would wait until the keeper was right behind when he pooed. Now, if you've ever seen how much an elephant poos, you do not want to be behind an elephant when that happens. And in fact, it's a tradition in Sri Lanka that the elephants, they lead processions. And a couple of times, and I was well enough known and respected in Sri Lanka, a couple of times, you know, they led me in an elephant procession. I remember at Peradeniya University in Kandy, you know, I was going there to give a talk and I said, no, you have to do the procession. So I had the Kandyan drummers all dressed up and an elephant in front, and I had to walk right behind the elephant. It was one of the scariest times. Not because the elephant would poo, I could probably get out of that, but imagine if an elephant passed wind. Now that would just... I'd be gassed and I would probably pass out. So you have to consider such things. But fortunately, the elephant was well behaved. But this elephant used to be well behaved, but now became really sort of a nasty minded elephant. And so the king was quite surprised, and so maybe he's got sick or something, some disease, but the elephant doctor checked everything and he was perfectly healthy. So then, this was one of the Jataka stories, and those stories where the Bodhisattva, the Buddha-to-be, was involved. And so, one of the ministers serving the king was the Buddha-to-be, and so he said, look, I'll try and find out the reason for this, leave it to me. And so the minister just spent all night by the elephant stall, just meditating, just relaxing. And early in the morning, the minister heard some really strange noises. And the minister crept quietly through the bushes and found right at the back of the elephant stall, there was a camp, a meeting ground of these thieves and violent people who would use that place as a meeting place early in the morning to decide, you know, who they were going to rob, beat up for their debts, or, you know, just to murder even. There were some really bad people, and that's where they met every evening. And the minister realized what had happened. Even though the elephant could not understand human speech, could still understand these were bad people, and what we used to call the bad vibes of bad people talking like that, and was influenced by that and picked up some of the bad habits. And so all the minister did, he had told the king, had all those bad guys arrested the next night and replaced with monks. And the monks did some chanting and meditated, discussed Dhamma. And in a few more days, the elephant was back to normal again, and even better than before. Understanding the influence of other people is really important. And because of that, when I tell that story, a lot of times people say, oh, can I send my husband to stay with you for a few days? Because even if he's not a Buddhist and doesn't do any meditation, just hanging around good, kind monks, you know, he picks up on the good vibes of the monks, becomes a better human being. And he returns home, you know, like tuned up, improved. It's like giving your husband a service every year, like you give your car a service at the garage. The only problem is, of course, if too many of those husbands come to the monastery, then the monks pick up on the... But But anyway, that was an interesting part, and it's actually quite true. So if you are a control freak person, going to sort of a therapist or something costs a lot of money, but just going around other people who are relaxed and at ease, and sometimes that's what you get here, just, you know, because I'm a really relaxed monk and at ease, that sometimes you pick up, even though it's not what I say or do, just you pick up on the energy, and a little laugh, a sort of chuckle when you do something weird or strange, instead of being shouted at. It means you do open up, you loosen up, you don't feel so protective of yourself, and so afraid of being criticized, which means you do loosen, and your control freakness starts to lessen. So sometimes, be around good people. Especially, you know, you have to say this, like monks and nuns, good monasteries, you know, kind people, or, you know, other people of other religion, good religious people, who are always happy and just opening the door of their heart to you, not criticizing you. And you feel just so welcome at those places. And that actually changes you. So associating with good people is wonderful. Next question. What do you think about deja vu? I knew I was going to get a question on that today. Now I'm only making that up. Because sometimes when I attend your Dharma talk, I feel like I've seen one part of the scene before. It's been on YouTube. I give so many talks, it's bad to be on YouTube. What do you think about that? Thanks. Yeah, I mean, but sometimes there is real deja vu, but a lot of times it's hard to actually prove. You know, is this something we've actually seen before? Or is it something which we think we've seen before, but we've just seen it, so we can't really prove it? But anyway, there is some really weird stuff which we have in our world. Weird stuff. In my family, that my mother and her cousin, who they grew up as sisters, because my grandma and her sister, you know, they only had a child each, and that was my mother and my auntie. So they grew up together, so, you know, to all intents and purposes, you know, she was my mother's sister. And just after the Second World War in England, you know, they were young ladies, you know, looking for their partners in life. And before even they found their partners, that they decided to go, you know, just for fun, just for something to do, to go to one of these mediums. Just to see, just a bit of interest, nothing to lose. And this medium, almost like a fortune teller, a spiritualist, looked at my auntie and said to her, "You know, you're soon going to meet your husband." "Oh, yeah." "And, you know, his name is going to be Donald, his surname Wolfreys." It was so specific. You know, Donald was a very common name, but Wolfreys? How do you know anyone called Wolfreys? And, you know, she thought, this is really weird, this is crazy, this is mad. So she didn't really believe it. My mother was there at the time, and I interrogated her many times. "Did this really happen?" She said, "Yeah, it happened." And then about a few days later, a week later, they went to one of the dances that they did in the old days. And don't, you know, not raves or nightclubs, you know, it was like a quite proper dance. And this nice young man came up to my auntie, asked her to dance. "Oh, yeah." And he asked, "What's your name?" And her name was Opal. My mother's name was Hazel. So her name was Opal. And said, "What's your name?" "Donald." And I often ask, "Why did you feel that? You must have been really excited or, you know, just afraid or something." And she said, "No, I was actually quite calm," which was really weird. And I said, "What's your surname?" "Wolfreys." And they were married over 50 years. And now she's still alive. Amazing. She's in her 90s now. And but her husband, Donald, he died about 2 or 3 years ago. And they're married for all that time. And this person just said, they didn't know each other before, never met anybody, met each other before. You're going to marry like Donald Wolf is. And she did. And that was really weird. Deja vu? Now that's deja vu. Weird stuff. But of course it doesn't always happen like that. But sometimes it does. And I wish I remembered these people's names. But there was a couple who came on one of the retreats some years ago. And I think he was Australian, she was, I think, German or French or something. And, you know, I had to try and scold them a little bit because they're supposed to be keeping, you know, precepts, especially 8 precepts, but they couldn't keep their hands off each other. And always, you know, sitting right next to each other and not listening to me but talking to one another. And so, but they said they couldn't help it. And they told me their story that, I think over in Europe somewhere, he was working in some business in Europe, and at some function, he'd never seen her before in his life, and she just came up to him and said, I'm going to marry you, and your name is David, David something. And he never met her before. She never met him, but she knew his name. She said, I just knew his name, who he was. And I knew that that's my husband. And I've got to marry him and stay with him. And I asked him, what do you think about that? He said, yeah, I knew she was right. And that's why they, you know, they obviously became very spiritual, because there's some weird stuff going on in this world. And that's why they came here. But, you know, that they weren't very good at keeping precepts. But you can sometimes understand why. They were just, their attraction together was huge. So anyway, that sometimes those things happen. Deja vu. And what's the last story? The last story about this was, it was a lady, a wannabe actress, who lived in South Australia, in Adelaide. And her name was Kelly. I know that. And I won't say what the surname is, because that would give the game away, but give the story away. But Kelly, just, you know, wannabe actress from a poor family, with her best friend, decided to go to the movies one night. And when she went to the movie, the old-time movie theatres, and you don't have the videos or whatever, you actually go to a cinema. And if you remember those cinemas, on the outside of the cinema was the name of the movie they were showing, and the photos of some of the scenes, especially the actors and actresses who were going to be starring in that movie. And when she got to the theatre, according to her best friend confirms this, Kelly, the wannabe actress, looked at the lead actor in that movie, pointed to him and said, I'm going to marry him. The movie was Grease. The actor was, what was his name, ma'am? John Travolta. Yeah, John Travolta. And they're still married after all these years. And it's perhaps, they always call that the most stable marriage in Hollywood. You know, most people in Hollywood, they marry for about 2 or 3 years and then they get divorced and they do all sorts of weird stuff. But, you know, for that couple, they've been together forever. And imagine that. It's a film star. And you see a picture of him and say, I'm going to marry him. Yeah, sure. You won't even probably meet him. But they did. And they've been married for such a long time. It was her deja vu. And, you know, how she knew that, you answer me. But anyway, that's the deja vu. I feel like I've seen one part of the scene before. Sometimes that could be true. Anyway, being a monk, is it like he or she is running away from the reality to be freed? Is also considered being selfish, leaving everything behind, including family, an example of spouse and kids. If anybody comes to me, and sometimes they do, and they say they want to ordain as a monk or as a nun, but they've got kids, no way. I say, you know, look after your children, look after your wife, look after your husband first of all. Because if you're that irresponsible, you're going to run away from your kids. You're never going to make it as a monk or a nun. It's not just being selfish, it's actually no self, it's just going way past that. So, and from the reality, it's amazing that word reality, the real world. You make reality. And this, you know, this is not just Heisenberg's uncertainty principle or Schrodinger's equation, where you actually create most of the reality and your concerns. But this is that world in which we live. You're even your partner. You know, who is she? Who is he? I can see your partner and I think there's one person. You look at them and they're a total different person. Who's real and who's not? You got, you know, Mr. Trump and fake news and real news. And, you know, don't judge him too harshly, because it's amazing just how we do the same, maybe even lesser. We see what we want to see. And we, unfortunately, he's in a position of power, and just that sort of distortion of reality can be incredibly dangerous. But each one of us does that to a certain extent about our health, our age, our abilities. Oh, I can do that. You can't, but you just, you know, want to prove yourself. Oh, I can't do that. You haven't tried yet. You know, there was one time when I was a school teacher, there was this boy, and he was in my maths class, and you know, I checked up on him and said, oh, this guy's hopeless. He came bottom of the class in maths the previous year. And you know, when they say he's hopeless, there's something which just really just I'm passionate about, that what do you mean he's hopeless? Give him a chance. No, he can't do it. It's proven the year before. And there's something inside me thinking that everybody's capable of anything. And it's just your belief, your confidence. Like even those jhanas, anyone can do that if you really believe you can. And I proved that a few times. Most unlikely people, give them a bit of encouragement and they make it. So this little kid, bottom of the class, in maths, I was teaching him and the rest of the 29 kids in the class, and I decided to do an experiment. Is it the case that this boy just can't do maths, that there's something wrong with his mathematical part of his brain? So to do this experiment, I made sure I gave that child extra attention, every lesson. You know, just, John, do you understand that? I'd go, you know, between the desk and I'd look over, this is what you're supposed to do, it's this, this and this. And so, oh yeah, I get it now. And I was always encouraging him at the expense of every other child in the class. It was unfair, but I admit that. But I encouraged him at the end of the class, you know, any questions you want to ask, you know, it's, oh no, thank you, sir, I understood this. And I gave him special attention, encouragement, just to see what would happen at the end of the year. He did come top at the end of the year, from bottom of the class to top of the class, just because he needed confidence to be instilled in him. And once he had that confidence, you know, he thrived. So that's one of the real world. And if you believe that you can't do things, if you believe you don't deserve happiness, if you believe that, you know, that there's some fault in you, that you're damaged goods, if you believe that, you create a world which is as real as any other world for you, but it's not a very helpful world to live in. It's a world of a lot of suffering. But if you look at it in the other way, yeah, you're a tree in the forest. Your damage can be your beauty, your feature. And if you look at it that way, it's amazing. Just you create another world for yourself, which is just as legitimate, just as real, but more positive. So that's why we create worlds. Which one do you want to create for yourself and others? So anyway, that you don't leave everything behind. Sometimes if you become a monk like me, oh, I became a monk just to live a nice, easy life. Now look at me. I worked very hard. There was a a talk I gave in Singapore at the Harbour Centre or something. Anyway, there was a big talk. I think it was the Buddhist Union were having their 50th anniversary, so they invited me to give a talk. There's over 1,000 people there. And at the end of the talk, questions. And so this gentleman came up to the microphone and he said, "Yes, what you've just been teaching us is all very well, but you're a monk. You don't know, you know, what the world is like. It's so stressful, you know, relationships, work, money problems, you know, tiredness, and so many things you have to balance. It's all very well, but, you know, what does a monk know?" And again, that sort of irritated me, and so I said, "Well, give me the microphone." I said, "Sir, this is what I was been doing the past 18 hours. Now, I usually get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, sometimes earlier, and that's when I started my work. And this is what I've been doing all day. Even lunch, you know, is not free time for me. People come up and ask me questions, and as soon as you've finished the lunch, then you've got to sort of start answering their questions about their life, their family, their problems, and even lunch is not free. You know, Sompong knows that, just, you know, a Thai supporter, you know, when you offer monks the food, then people are always just asking questions. So you say, leave him alone, he's eating. But then just afterwards, they come up, you want some more, or something happens, and you're looking at people all the time, you're eating in public. Sometimes, Ajahn Chah said, it's like being a monkey in the zoo. They feed you and they watch you, see what you eat. Sometimes it's like that, we don't mind. So the whole day, and I said, this is what I've been doing all day. And now at the end of the day, it was about 10:30 or something. Now you've asked your question. And that was my schedule for today. So what do you mean? Just, you know, I'm a monk, I don't know what hard work is like. And so he came to the microphone. And he said, "Ajahn Bhav, thank you for telling me that." He said, "I never realized how hard modern monks have to work." And he said, "I always wanted to be a monk one day, but not now. I'll stick to being a computer programmer," he said. So anyway, so we don't run away. If you run away, even that, people ask me, why did I become a monk? I wasn't running away from a broken relationship. I wasn't running away from suffering. I was running towards happiness. Honestly, meditation was such an incredible source of happiness. And I was running towards that. Running towards service, joy, being of use. No running away, but running towards. Anyway, the person who committed suicide, will he or she be punished in the future life? There was, a few years ago, a Sri Lankan family, they came, they rang up, they were just really traumatized. And they were in a rage retreat. I had to stop what I was doing and just talk to them. And what had happened? Their 17-year-old boy, it was about September, October, their 17-year-old boy, they woke up in the morning and they found him on the end of a rope on the veranda. Imagine waking up like that. And they had he had a younger brother who just would not talk. He just went so shocked, he wasn't speaking to anybody. And that happened in the morning, and just so that they were just so, you know, confused more than grieving. They hadn't got to grief yet. What had happened? It was shock. And so, you know, the father just respected me a lot, so they came to Bodhinyana Monastery in the evening. And just, of course, I always think that, why did they do that? Because the boy was, you know, very popular at school. He had lots of friends. He had shown no sign of depression at all, which often happens. The family were really good parents. There's no reason for it, and a lot of time you cannot find a reason. blaming. No one was to blame. But then they asked the same question. Does that mean that our son's going to go to hell for this? And that also really irritates me when people say things like that. Imagine that, you know, your loved one has just committed suicide. That's bad enough. And it's just like twisting the knife in the wound. Yeah, he's going to go to hell too. Thank you. You know, that's my son. I love him. And it's already bad enough. And now you say he's going to be tortured for eternity. That doesn't help one bit. And it's also not true. So I asked him, he said, 17, he must be, at that time of the year, about to do his tertiary entrance exams. You know, the exams they do at the end of the school year to qualify for university or not. That wasn't the cause of his suicide. He was doing really well. You know, he's going to go to, you know, all the teachers said, you know, maybe do a good course over in University of West Australia. He's very smart. But I said that, how many subjects is he studying for the year 12 final exams? And they said, I think five. I said, how many papers in each subject? They didn't know where I was going with this, but they said about two papers, so that's 10 exams he has to do. And how many questions will he maybe answer in each exam? And they didn't know, I didn't know, but I said maybe eight. Eight questions in each exam. So that's 80 questions he will have to answer. And that, on that basis of that, he will get a good position in university to study for a degree, or he won't. Now imagine, just imagine for the sake of this argument, imagine 79 of those 80 questions he answered perfectly. And the very last question on that paper, he made a big mess of. A really wrong answer. Would your son still go to a good university? 79 out of 80? Of course they would. So now you understand why I said this. Your son was a very good man, very sort of polite and respectful to his parents, hard worker, never causing any problems or difficulties. He did so many right answers in his life. It's only the last one where he committed suicide, he made a big mistake. 79 out of 80 doesn't mean you get sent to hell. It means you probably get a very good life. So don't just judge a life on how it ended. You judge the whole life if you're going to judge anything, not just how the final act unfolded. So it's not good to commit suicide, but that's just the final act. What else did the person do in their life? And of course you think, well, my goodness, they're a really good, kind person, a wonderful person. So of course they're going to get a good rebirth. So that, hopefully that answers the question. How to overcome greed. Trying to overcome it is another form of greed. So you don't overcome it, you understand it. Now, the greed, where does it... Is that going to cause any happiness for me? Is that going to cause happiness for others? And I think you all know that giving to somebody else is way, way more satisfying than keeping it for yourself. There's so many stories that... Oh, one which comes to mind. I was just passing, you know, through Singapore Airport, you know, 'cause that's the nearest place for when I go travelling. And there's no real direct flights from Perth to anywhere. There are a few more now, but I usually have to go to Singapore before I can get a connecting flight. So that I was going through the airport and... there was this young lady, 22, 23. You know, she was a backpacker and she was trying to get some sleep. And it's on one of the benches and she was going up, backwards and forwards, rolling around, holding the eyes because it was really loud and noisy. And also so much light in the place. And when I go on those aircraft, I collect the eye shades. And I collect them because I've got a whole heap of them in my office over here. If anybody finds it difficulty in meditation, you know, because there's lights coming on or something, and you put the eye shades on, they're really, really helpful. So if you need any eye shades, sometimes nimitters, but it can't be an nimitter, put the eye shade on, then you know it's not an nimitter. Or sometimes when you get to that stage of meditation, there's another phenomena which no one has actually mentioned yet, but it sometimes happens, your eyes flutter. And it's just because psychologically you're seeing a light, but then it's not really a light, so even the physiology of the eye gets a bit confused, and you're fluttering your eyelids in meditation. And so you put those eye shades on, it fixes the problem. So those eye shades are quite helpful for people when they're meditating. So if any need any of those, you know, just got heaps of them over there. And so I had some spare ones, not just one, you know, two or three. And I saw this poor little woman there just trying to get some sleep. And so I just got out of my bag and said, "Do you want an eye shade, madam?" And she just looked at me as if, "Wow, it's amazing. I don't even know you. Thank you so much." And that created so much joy in the whole journey when I remembered a little act of kindness like that to help a person just get a little bit of sleep, you know, on a long journey in an airport. And that's why giving and kindness, greed, I don't. You get this wonderful opportunity to create happiness. So I suppose I am greedy for happiness, greedy for service, greedy to see somebody get very happy because I can just serve and help them a little bit. That's the greed I have. So you don't accumulate things. You share them out and you get much, much, much more joy by looking after others. So yeah, that's what greed is, and it's good. Somebody said that was in a movie somewhere. Some like Mr. Lizard or something. Greed is good. Anyway, it's just what they meant is accumulating money. But accumulating kindness and beautiful memories, that type of greed is good. When I meditate, it's like my mind making a story. It's not happening in the past, it's not what I want to happen in the future, it's not even real, sometimes trivial. How to deal with it? The reason you get stories and fantasies and sometimes memories is because you are bored, you're not happy, you're not satisfied, and you've got this whole database of fantasies and stories. If it's actually a real story which has happened before, I mean, that's just, you know, you can't do much about that. But fantasies, you can be the hero, because in those stories of fantasies, you're always the hero, you're always the winner, you're always the person who kicks the winning goal at the last minute in the World Cup, you know, for Hong Kong. They'd never won it before, but you make them win it. You're the person who is on the aircraft on Cathay Pacific and you save the day by finding where the bomb is and just throwing it out the window and everybody's saved. You're the hero. Or you're the person who wins a lottery and gives all the money to the next Ajahn Brahm's next meditation center. And in your dreams, you can do stuff like that. In real life, it never happens. So that's why you have the Walter Mitties of life, because they make so this dream world. And each one of us does that to a certain extent. And I remember as a young monk doing stuff like that, just passing the time. But then what I used to do is I'd actually put it on fast forward. Then what? Then what? Then what? Then what? Until you came to the end, then you die. So what? So you score the winning goal for some team, or you marry the most beautiful girl in the world, and then she gets ugly as she gets old. You get very, very rich, and then just, so what? You get lots of money, then what are you going to do with it? And then you become, you save the whole world, and then you die, and then the world gets corrupt again, and just, I actually added just then what from reality. And then so after a while, it just was not really worth those fantasies. But I realized it wasn't just worthwhile. I was just running away from the reality of now. And after a while, I was scared of being peaceful. And after a while, when you look at peace and you befriend peace, then this moment is much more enjoyable than any fantasy, any movie, any sort of superhero. Just being this moment is more than good enough. So you don't go to your data bank of fantasies and dreams and plans. Even planning, I often say that if I don't plan, sort of things go wrong. If I do plan, they go wrong anyway. Either way, I have to deal with things not going according to plan or unexpected stuff happening in my life. And so I decided, you know, if it's going to go wrong anyway, just why plan? Enjoy it before it goes wrong. So don't worry so much. Oh, that's a greed question. I'll put Odin back. Will animals reincarnate? If yes, will they become human beings? And what factors will determine this? Yes, many animals have become human beings. People often ask that question. Look, just do the math. There are more people alive today on this planet Earth than have ever died. It's a simple equation. It's weird. There's more people alive today than have ever died. And it's quite likely, unless there's been some mass extinctions in the past. So where did all the human beings come from? But what other animals, or what other beings, sentient beings, have decreased? Look at how many animals, like primates, gorillas, orangutans, have. Their numbers have gone way down and they're almost facing extinction. So, the answer is quite obvious that Mr. Trump was an orangutan. Look at his hair. All these rough people you see, you know, in the sort of the worst part, you know, the bikies, the Hell's Angels, these rough people. They were gorillas before. I don't know, but certainly just there's no problem at all of transcending the species barrier. And anyway, species? Being a scientist, there was this gentleman called Linnaeus, I think in Belgium or some sort of European, and it was him who classified all the fauna, the living beings, sentient beings of this planet Earth, classified them into different species. And in order to classify all these beings and different species, you know, the mammals, the what are the kangaroos, what they call marsupials, in order to classify them, he had his scheme. You know, it's just questions to ask of each type of being so that he could classify them objectively. And in his autobiography, or what he left at the end when he died, it was only released after he passed away, he said one of the worst decisions he made was actually to forget, you know, his objective criteria for classifying species. There are for three types of beings: Homo sapiens, the chimpanzees and the gorillas, the primates. Because he said they were the same species. Science told him they were the same, one species. But he said, if he publishes results at that time, over 100 years ago, where that the chimpanzees, gorillas, human beings, if he put them all in the same category, he would be laughed at he would lose his reputation. His work would never be published again. Because we always think that human beings are something special. But they're the same. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, the going from one species to another, never being reborn, is pretty easy. So if you have a child and they're exceptionally hairy, maybe, where did they come from? Oftentimes I am unsure if I'm watching my breath or I'm actually controlling it. How do we distinguish? Very hard to make that distinction, but once it starts to get beautiful, delightful, and you get the sense of ease and relaxing, that's a good sign that you are not controlling anymore. Because if you're controlling, it has to get tense. And you can feel the difference between tension and like ease and freedom and the joy of relaxation. That's one of the reasons why that when we start the meditation, feel the body and relax all the different parts of the body, your body feels really comfortable and at ease when you do a bit of relaxation. Or, you know, or you get somebody to massage you, and after a good massage, everything feels nice and relaxed. You're not tightening up anymore. You're not controlling, you're not pulling and pushing or squashing things anymore. It's just natural, open, at ease. And so the delight and sense of freedom which you feel with a relaxed body is the same with your breath. You're not controlling it, and you feel it's very different. It's just to breathe in and breathe out naturally, without any force, and you just let it be, and it does it much better when you don't control. And you can feel that, it's delightful, easy, and so you get a lot of feedback. If you're watching your breath, if it's controlling it, it's tight, and it never gets to the delightful breath where Piti Sukha comes up. At least it's not very nice Piti Sukha. Can we do meditation in a noisy place like on the way to work or when we are feeling unwell or sick? Of course you can. But what you do, you don't fight the noise. Ajahn Chah used to say, it's not the noise disturbs you, it's you who disturb the noise. And I mentioned that to this monk who's at Bodhinyana Monastery now. His brother came from Europe to visit, and they were both getting on, and there was no place they could stay. So I said, well, look, if your brother comes to visit, maybe just get a place in a hotel nearby or something, because there's no place to stay. He said, look, it's my brother. We grew up together. We can share the room together. I said, look, at your age, that one of you is going to start snoring. And you know, probably both of you will snore eventually, but if he starts snoring, you're going to be awake all the night. He said, oh, I understand that. My brother does snore, I know that. My plan is I'll go to sleep first. And if I go to sleep first, when I start snoring, my brother can't sleep. That's not very nice, but he said, oh, well, you know, here's my brother, I'll find a way. And so he told me the following day that his brother went to sleep so quickly and he was snoring like an elephant, not a real elephant, like a jumbo jet. Just really loud. And so he thought, oh, what am I going to do now? I'm not going to get any sleep all night. But then he remembered these great teachings. It's not the noise disturbs you, you disturb the noise. Now, how can I do that with this terrible sleep and snoring in this very small room? So then he decided to use his perception. Instead of looking at the noise as something disturbing, he started to imagine that snoring as some cutting-edge, modern, sort of musical composition. You know, not the normal stuff. If you ever heard like modern jazz, it just, you know, eventually he managed to see there was a rhythm in it. And there was like a percussion there. Or whatever it was. And no, he was very, very refined, educated European, and known so many different types of music. And after a while, his perception changes. So this is really cutting edge. You know, this is not your normal type of music. This is unregulated. The tones were just totally different than anything he'd heard before. And it actually started, the experimental part of the music started actually to feel really interesting. And he woke up in the morning, just his last memory was just how marvellous, how sonorous and cutting edge was his brother snoring. It actually, he was enjoying it. And that's why he wasn't fighting it and how he went to sleep. So it's amazing, the psychology. So if you want to meditate in a noisy place, you can't fight the noise. So you learn how to love the noise, as that monk did. It's brilliant. If you're feeling unwell or sick, I always thought you can never sort of meditate when you're really, really sick. But there was that story of when I had typhus fever. And please, it's personal stories, because you know they're real for me. It's not just I heard this monk say you can do this, or it says in the suttas, yes, it can be done. It's my own experience. I had typhus fever. And the doctors never knew what it was. We're not supposed to have typhus fever in that part of Thailand. There's no record of it. And of course, it was only the Westerners. You know, the locals had immunity over generations. So they thought it wasn't there. Eventually we found out it was typhus fever. It's like typhoid. So you really get sick and very, very weak. And to cut along, that was actually when Ajahn Chah came to visit me one day. And this is where this story came from. You know, I felt really just, you know, so weak and so, that's not what I came to Thailand for. Just fevers, aching, couldn't even stand up. We didn't even have any bedpans. You had to try and crawl to the toilet, which was always really dirty. And there was, first night I was there feeling terrible, the night nurse, the nurse left at 6 p.m. and the night nurse never turned up. And I knew enough Thai, I told the monk sitting in the next bed, you know, these ward, six beds on either side. I said, well, you know, where's the night nurse? Shall we call someone to get the night nurse? Hasn't turned up. And he looked at me as if I was crazy. There is no night nurse. It's a third world hospital, the monk's ward. If anything goes wrong at night, it's just bad karma. That's not what I got used to. National Health Service in England, you got looked after. Here, it was just, you know, you were on your own. That was really scary. But anyway, Ajahn Chah came to visit. And the great Ajahn Chah, you know, my master, and he came to visit me. He was really busy, he had so many other people to visit, but, you know, he came to visit me, and I felt so privileged and honored until he opened his mouth. Ajahn Chah. And he said to me, that phrase, you've heard me say it many times before, he said to me, you will either get better or you will die. And he left. Thank you so much. That was so true, because the sickness wouldn't last. So he didn't have to endure the aches and the pains and the fevers that much longer. He'll either kill you or you know, it will disappear itself. You'll either get better or you'll die. When you go visiting your elderly mother, don't say that. Maybe it was okay for a monk to a monk, but it was pretty tough to take. But of course, eventually it did disappear. But one, I wish I'd have had just a bit more understanding of these deep meditations at the time. But and I got so sort of tired and depressed, okay, because low energies. And I thought, all right, just, I can't take this much longer. So I thought, come on, let's meditate. Why not? So laying down there in this bed with a fever, absolutely zero energy, I just tried meditating. I was a pretty rebellious monk. You're not supposed to do this, but I decided, yeah, why not? Let's give it a try. Try it, see what happens. And that's the sort of rebelliousness of a scientist. And so, give it a try. And so I got this wonderful meditation. The body vanished. Imagine, if you've got a fever and you're just aching all over and absolutely zero energy, so actually to do that was just, oh, such a release. You're blissing out. You couldn't feel the body and the contrast to what you're feeling before, with achy, painful, just sick body, and now you are just so peaceful, so blissed, was immense. So when I came out of that meditation, the thing I really noticed was my posture. If ever you've been in bed really sick, you find you don't actually sit cross-legged with the right arm over the left arm, with your back straight. Your arms are all over the place, and your leg, one leg's this way, one leg's the other way, and just your robes are all over the place too. There's, you know, when people wake up in the morning, just their body's all over the place. And I looked at my body, and I always remember that. I said, I've just had one of the most wonderful meditations, and look at this posture. I've never seen this posture in any meditation book, ever. And I realized that the posture is maybe helpful, but it's not important. Where you feel comfortable, that is the best posture for you. You don't have to. People say, oh no, you have to have your leg back straight, otherwise it doesn't work. You have to have your leg this way, your palms like this to create the circle or whatever. Oh, just so much. The first time I'm mentioning the word gomayang. It's a Pali word, gomayang. Go means ball. Mayang is what comes out the back end of a ball. But people don't like me saying bullshit. Oh, I just said it. So I say go mayang. So if it works, and I've proved it does work, so you can. But the reason I think I missed out something there when that experience, I should have really checked out, you know, maybe from some records, whether that was the moment the fever went and the sickness disappeared. Because often that's the case, what happens? These deep meditations are really powerful, they zap stuff. And, you know, going back, I wouldn't be surprised if that's when the fever broke and the disease just disintegrated and the recovery, getting your strength back, began in earnest. But so you can meditate when you're sick, when you're tired, if you know what to do. Would you please explain the concept of transference of merits? When is the appropriate time to do it? If we transfer the merits of the deceased who passed long ago, they still get it. I think I already mentioned that question in the 49 days one. Transferring some merits, it doesn't matter whether the person gets it or not. You need to give it. You need to do it. It's a beautiful thing to remember people who, without whom, you would not be here today. I feel so much gratitude for them. And even transferring some merits to Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah doesn't need merits. That would be like giving a $100 donation to Bill Gates. A little drop in the ocean. He wouldn't even notice that $100 was actually added to his account. Just like an Ajahn Chah, you know, just transferring merits to an Ajahn Chah, he's still got heaps of merits. But that's not the point. The point is that we need to give. Whether they need to receive it, or they do receive it, is secondary. Do you have any practical tips or advice on how we can retain some degree of stillness when we return to our usual lives outside of this centre? First of all, you've got many days to go yet. Now that's why you don't have any stillness, because you're way ahead of yourself. What day is it today? It's only Monday and you're already thinking about Sunday or Saturday or something. So if you want to retain some stillness and some peace and quiet, please spend more time in the present moment. And don't sacrifice and give up the stillness and quietness of today and tomorrow and the next day worrying about what would happen when you go home. It's amazing just how much we sacrifice portions of our lives waiting for the next thing to happen. During meditation today, my mind was suddenly flooded by recent events in Hong Kong, which was uncomfortable and lost connection with my breath. Should I stop meditating? How to handle it? No, stop connecting with the past. That happened in Hong Kong a long time ago. How long ago was that? That was at least 144,000 seconds ago. If it was yesterday. If you call it like yesterday, that's really close. If you do like 24 times 306, like 3,600, no, it's not that, it's I think it is about 108,000 or something. But anyway, it's a lot of seconds ago. And that makes it sound more. Just like sometimes, you know, Sompong knows this, the Thai lady, that sometimes when we do like a fundraising, and she said, how much did we make today? And I say, oh, today we raised over $1 million. Wow, she says. That's amazing. I never realized we got so many donations in the box. Yeah, $1 million. But isn't it sound more inspiring instead of $10,000 or something? $1 million. Wow, that's really good. Make it sort of a little fun. So it was followed by recent events in Hong Kong. Is there something you can do about it? The events in Hong Kong? If there's something you can do, then do it. If there's nothing you can do, then be still. Rest. You're here on this retreat. Please enjoy this retreat. Later on, who knows what happens in Hong Kong. But you're on this retreat, you're energizing yourself, getting perspective. Beautiful thing to do. So, you're really wasting this wonderful opportunity for freedom and peace by worrying about things which you cannot do anything about. Ajahn, is it true that karma can be passed down from family, parents to the kids and manifest into physical disabilities? Nope. We don't have group karma, we are owners of our karma. And some of the stuff which my father told me, that he was born in Liverpool. Apparently my brother actually did research and found out he was one of the last of the children of my family, but he was the only one, the first one, I think, who was legitimate. Because, in those days, he didn't marry, it was too expensive to get married. And so he had lots and lots of brothers, but his father, my own father, would never talk about his father, my paternal grandfather. And that was quite sort of frustrating for a while. And when I got sort of a certain age, I said, Dad, why didn't you tell me about, who was my grandfather? He died during the Second World War. I thought it may have been a bomb or something, but apparently it was TB killed him. My brother found that out. So it was really, really poor. And so I said, why don't you talk about my grandfather? And that's when my father, he decided it was time to tell me what had happened. And he said, and please excuse the words, he said, your grandfather was a bastard. And I was shocked, talking about your own father like that. But shocked, I needed to know. So why? Why do you call your own dad that terrible name? And then my father started to let on that my paternal grandfather was a plumber, hardly any work, recession time. And if he got any money, he would go to the pub and come home drunk every evening. Now, the beer was really cheap. And he would take off his leather belt and he would beat any kid, including my father, if he happened to be in the way, for no reason whatsoever. And my father would often say he could take any beating, but what he could never stand, what he could never endure, was when his father started whipping his mum, the wife. It was domestic abuse. You know, in a time when it was quite common and there was no way to stop it. And his impotence, he said, of seeing his father just treat his mother so cruelly, and he could not help his mum, the one person in the family he really loved and cared for, and he couldn't protect her from his dad. And he said that was traumatic for him. But, he said, that when he had kids, you know, actually he said when he was on the end of a whipping, you know, from his dad, drunken dad, he said he made a resolution, like a promise, if ever he survives, he lives through this, which he obviously did. And if ever he has children, he would never, ever beat them. And he never could. And that was a wonderful thing. I remember, you know, a few times my brother and I would fight, and, you know, we'd just make a loud noise at night. And my father would just come into the room with a slipper, but he couldn't do it. He just, you know, just went back again afterwards, you know, because we deserved it. Really did, but, you know, my father just remembered, recalled his childhood, and he couldn't hit us at all. You know, that promise was just so strong in him. And when I wish he'd have told me that before, we wouldn't have misbehaved so much. But what had happened, he'd been traumatized. You know, physical abuse as a child. And he turned it around. He dug in that dung. And, you know, he learned from it. That's not the way to treat people you love and care for. And he couldn't discipline us that way. So that was actually how the sins of your fathers did not need to pass on from one generation to the next. My father showed me that. And so there is another way. You know, whatever difficulties and problems you had, whether it's sexual abuse or child abuse or sort of physical abuse, you can actually just dig that dung in and change it all around and become incredible people. This shows his hope. Anyway, the last question. I know recording how people treat me badly and being angry with them is suffering. I can stop thinking about it when I'm awake, but these thinking come subconsciously in my dreams. I feel upset when I wake up. How can I let go of the bad feeling and anger? Thanks so much, Ajahn Brahm. What you do is actually when you go to bed at night, one of the things which even was in the suttas by the Buddha taught, just have some loving kindness. May all beings be happy and well. May I be happy and well. They're imperfect human beings. I'm an imperfect human being. But, you know, I need a nice sleep and may I have a beautiful sleep. And remember all of the eggs which I've collected and I've seen other people collect today. And leave the shit in the past to rot. So when you go to bed, you remember all the times people have treated you badly? Why don't you deliberately remember all the times people have treated you with kindness and with respect? All the beautiful memories you've had today. And hopefully there have been many beautiful memories where people have smiled at you, they laughed when you saw the rainbow and take photos and all the jokes and stuff. All those wonderful times you've had today, remember those. And fill your life, your past anyway, your basket, which you take into bed with you tonight, with eggs. And don't bring the shit into the bed with you. It's crazy, isn't it? But that's what we do. And saying in a gross way like that, you know, really imprints it. You really understand what's going on. And we remember the happy memories. and the bad memories, you know, what do you do with shit? That's why you've got an ensuite. Leave it in there and flush it away and keep the eggs. And that means you have a wonderful sleep at night. And you wake up a better human being, rested, positive, so you can serve others in this world. And just a little smile, a bit of kindness, because you're not still working through your own problems. You're free to help others. Oh no, there's another question which is hiding. Because it was on the side here and I thought I was empty. But I'll leave that till tomorrow, because I'd always just finished off. So one question for tomorrow. So anyway, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. So I wish you all a really happy night, a beautiful sleep, and remember all the positive things you've learnt and done today.